John Shillag, Reel 8.
I brought myself out of the army.
How did you do that?
The simple story of it is, I paid a lot of money to somebody. It was far more complicated than that. And in fact, it was another one of my father's contacts from the early days, who actually was stationed in the Soviet Commandatura in Vienna, who said that I was marrying her daughter. Some cock and bull story, but anyway, money was the main thing. And the compensation from the nationalization for either the construction firm or the anchor's transport business wasn't. It was a lot of money in Hungarian terms, but it wasn't all that much money. But most of that was used in the bribe. And it was not actually getting out from the army. It was a deferment. So I had to come back a year hence, or whatever the period was. And because all my achievements in the 7 weeks, I was promoted from nothing to sergeant, I think. So when I came back, I would have come back as sergeant. But instead of coming back as sergeant, in the meantime, I worked out things to lead to the best. And that I have done. In 1949. I have a feeling that I had to go back to the army in October. And not strictly, but following in my father's footsteps, I nicked across the border to Austria. He could do it straight across from here to Vienna, direct route. I had to go through barbed wire and mountains through Slovakia and then to Bratislava to Vienna.
Was that very dangerous? You know that.
It would have been virtually impossible to do the direct route because that was all barbed wire and minefields and whatever. But of course, Czechoslovakia was still, or was. Communist ally. So the border to there was that much easier. And at that stage, to go from Bratislava to the Austrian, across the Austrian border, was still just about possible. Probably about another 3 months later it was. Then I got across the Austrian border and it was all organized. So
what were the major risks, though? Were there mines or anything laid?
Not at that stage. 3 months later it was. I mean, you could have got caught on barbed wire. Or worse, you could have got either arrested or shot by a patrol. But anyway, managed to survive. That got across to Austria, and there was a truck waiting for us. And that part of Austria was relatively easy to get from Czechoslovakia because it was the Soviet occupation zone. Austria, in the same way as Germany, was divided into the four zones.
Were you alone? Were you alone?
I was with a group of about four or five people. One was a childhood friend, but the others were just some other Hungarian Jews, somehow getting on to the gravy train is probably the wrong expression, but getting across on the same trip. Anyway, it was all organized, and there was a truck waiting for us on the Austrian side. still Soviet occupation zone, Abkhazia. And somehow the Russians got wind of what was going on. And we were chased virtually from the border into Vienna by the Russians. And we got into Vienna, into the main arterial road. And Vienna was divided into four zones, and that was patrolled by the four Allied powers. And no matter which country was in charge that particular month, because they rotated month by month, it was always the American who was driving the jeep. And the poor American, he mixed up his accelerator and his brake, and just couldn't catch up with us. And anyway, the truck sailed right across into the American zone. It was all right. And then we were flagged down by the Austrian police. And we were fined on the spot. And the equivalent of probably about 2 shillings, but we got not 10 for exceeding the speed limit on the Rundstrasse. So there I was in the West. I was in the West, I was in Vienna, but I was still in the Soviet occupation zone. And one of the old local hospitals in Vienna, the hospital, was turned over as an immigration center, if you like, a reception center. And it was treated in much the same way as the houses were in Budapest in wartime. Yes, it was in the American zone, but technically I think the Russians could come into the American zone in the month they were in charge of the city. But they couldn't come into the hospital because that was an American protected area. Anyway, I was there for a few months. And while I was there, I applied for visas to go somewhere in the West. And I put in applications for the States, Canada, and Australia. And the Australians came good first. So that way I eventually finished up.
Were you interrogated at all by the Americans?
Yes. Now, I put this probably in two or three parts. Yes, I was interrogated by the Americans. I was interrogated by the International Refugee Organization. I was interrogated by the United Nations, if you like. And much later, and that is a story in itself, and I have to think hard how much of it I can tell you, because there must still be some long-term rules on that one. But anyway, tell you about that later. The Americans obviously concentrated on my military career, if you can call it that. And whatever else. The United Nations was interesting for a completely different reason, because the chief interrogator was somebody who escaped with the Germans from Hungary, arrow cross board. And I think I was probably the only, or just about the only, Jew who was cleared organization by the International Refugee Organization in Vienna, cleared in the sense that I didn't need any clearance, but the United Nations paid my fares to wherever I was going. Whereas most Jews had to rely on the American joint paying their expenses.
Why was that, do you think? Why you...
I don't know. I mean, my story fitted better than others who were just Jews per Jew's sake, economic refugees, which, as you know, today is a different category from the political. But I had enough sort of political background to justify this clear. Anyway, I was still in the Russian zone, and then the Americans got me over to Steyr in the American zone. And after a couple of months there, the train load was taken to Italy. First to a camp in Bonagilla, which is on the Adriatic side, and then just south of Naples, and was a very large, probably one of the largest buildings I have seen in all my life, except the Quarry Hill flats in Leeds. Which was originally the training camp for the Balillas, the Italian young fascists. And that was sort of a dispatch center for the various refugees who were then shipped from Naples to Verona. And I went down there, the restaurant there, and virtually the first person serving behind the counter was, I saw there was a second cousin who was waiting for a long, long time to go to America. And I also helped him, because he was saying he doesn't know why he's getting interrogated by the Americans day in, day out. They just don't want to give him a visa. And I knew exactly why he wouldn't get a visa. He had exactly the same name, and he was a journalist as well, originally. As a journalist who was reporting day in, day out the Cardinal Vincenti trial from Hungary. And the Americans somehow thought that he was that guy. But I knew the other guy as well, and I could explain the situation, who the other one was, and where he is, and that he isn't him. And shortly after that, he got his clearance, and he was now somewhere in Hollywood or wherever. I was in the Bonagilla camp, but that was the staging post for going to Australia. And one morning, we were taken by truck to the naval shipyard in Naples, and put with about 1,300 other migrants bound for Australia, because I was going to Australia because they came first with their visa to go there. I applied to Canada and States as well. I was on my way to Australia. American spooky. And we came to Suez Canal and to Colombo. And we just left Colombo when there was a Cold War incident in which an American plane, presumably a spy plane, was shot down over Leningrad or in that neighborhood. And the vessel I went to Australia on was the U.S. Navy vessel. And they put on a full military alert they had to follow. So all the way from Colombo to Sydney, we went non-stop at a very high speed. And during that journey, the small American military or navy crew was bringing up from the bars of the ship anti-aircraft guns and various armaments, which during the Cold War, apparently, they had all on board, and they had instructions to proceed to the Sydney Navy Dockyard immediately on arrival. And, well, all that thing said fizzed out, but just shows how the situation was in those days. Anyway, I arrived in Sydney in April 1950, and I had to do directed labor, which I'd done for 2 years. After those 2 years, I went on to a hydroelectric steam, one of the biggest hydroelectric steams in the world, the Snowy Mountain steam. I met my wife there, we got married there. The church where we got married is now on the 100 feet of water on the bottom of one of the dams. We had our children there.
How many children?
I got 3 children all together. All the 2 were born on the hydroelectric project. And my youngest daughter was born in Sydney. We were in Sydney by that time. And my wife is English. She's sort of fairly settled in Australia. My daughter has Down syndrome, and in those days there was very little doing there. So mainly because of that, we decided to come to UK, the National Health Service, and all that. That's how we came then in 1962 to the UK. After I worked on the Snowy scheme, we moved to Sydney, and there I joined the Atomic Energy Commission there. I was there for 5 years before coming back to the UK. And I was hoping and was made to understand that when we get back to the UK, there will be jobs waiting in one of the UK establishments, UK AEA establishments. And that was during the recession period. So when we got there, all came to nothing. Anyway, it didn't take very much time before I got a proper job. Before I was offered it, going to the labor exchange in my, so to say, dull days, one day they told me, yes, there is a job. They can't tell me anything about it, but here's the address. And I may wish to follow it up. And follow up I did. went to a London address given and was interviewed at length by a very English gentleman. The only thing that wasn't English about him, he was wearing monocle. And he was the first Englishman I ever saw with a monocle. But he was sort of inquiring about my time in Hungary, what I was doing. What eventually turned out to be quite evidently double-checking some of the things I had told him about jury itself. And then he put me in a room with a tape recording with some instructions. I cannot quite remember what it was. But prior to going after this so-called job, I also had an interview with the BBC for a job. I made a tape recording there. And in fact, it was the tape recording I'd done to BBC. But the job fairly obviously had nothing to do with that tape recording or the BBC. And anyway, it was all very mysterious. I probably would have been offered a job if I would have taken it. But I wouldn't have found out until I'd taken the job what the job was. And the final bit of my interview with the monocle gentleman was he was asking me, where am I going from here, physically? No, I told him, Kensington High Street or wherever I was going. Hang on a moment. Minutes later, he came back with an underground ticket to where I was going. And he ushered me out to take me at one of the exits of the building. And I found myself on the platform of the underground.
You weren't interested before then? Had you sort of...
I must have turned them down at one stage. Well, I can't remember now exactly when I turned them down. But before you put in it on again, what happened? When I was still in Australia, the Atomic Energy Commission was part of what in the UK was DSIR, the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research. And the secretary of DSIR, Sir Harry Mowry at the time, was a bit upset and worried that I'd been offered all these jobs to go to Harvard or wherever when I get to the UK and nothing can help it. And he took it upon himself to try to find me something within DSIR, and it was just about the time that the National Engineering Lab for Science and Technology was formed in Boston Spa, and he wondered whether I might be interested. And well, I was cutting at stores at that time, with three children, wife to support, and all that. Not just because of cutting at stores, but it seemed the right sort of job. And by that time, before Harry Melville done his bit, I had written to a library, which had just formed within the weeks I arrived in the UK, and had a turn down letter but you know, nothing doing now. There might be something some later time. But there were in fact two letters in the post. One saying what I just said, and the other one from Sir Harry saying, would I go to Boston Spa, go for an interview, and see how things develop. So I returned that and go ahead in the same post. And yes, I went up. Incidentally, I was living at the time within earshot virtually of my interviewer now. It was a long day to travel up to Leeds in those days, or York in those days. It's a long day now, but nothing like it. I've been offered a job. I joined the National Lending Library at Boston Spa. The offers that I had very much the same time. Was this mysterious job about which nobody could tell me anything what it would be. And another one actually in the line of atomic energy at the DSIR research laboratory in East Kilbride by Glasgow. Anyway, I joined the National Lending Library for Science and Technology, which in later years became part of the, and is now part of the British Library. And my director took me around the first day I was there and said, well, have a look at this material here. You speak German. Most of that seems to be German. See what you make of it. See what we can make of it. And looking through those documents, I found that it was the very same documents that I supervised the loading of in Buchenwald in 1945 from the factories surrounding the camp. All those documents that finished up in Boston Spa, where the National Lending Library was and is, originally from Buchenwald, and it was part of the Buchenwald documents. They were technical description of technical processes, patterns, factory drawings, and that sort of material, dealing with more civilian applications. The more military applications went to the Ministry of Defense. And dare I say it, the Ministry of Defense promptly lost it. And they turned up many years later at a disused airfield when some grazing cows fell into a hole in the ground and fell into these documents, onto those documents. And these were the more military type documents, you know, rocketry and armament and that sort of thing. And that airfield is in very close proximity where today Beit Shalom is, literally about a 5 minutes walk from there. And those documents obviously are now somewhere, either in the Ministry of Defense, or more likely together with the documents that were brought.